operative outline, just if you look at the division, you have that. I will use that to guide what I have to say. And again, what I want to do is at least this is really the big dance. Last Tuesday, Monday was nothing. It's the transcendental reduction in 1 week. And the idea of trying to get through the whole argument in 1 week is just so you can hopefully feel the structure of it and have some sense of it as a continuous argument. But since this is our shot at it, it's also up to you to slow me down, to say, wait a minute, this is not working, don't get it. These are the chances for you to really halt me over the movement of the mean deduction. So that's where we are. I take it that we're all on the same page. So let's actually get a page. Just because I think we have moved around paragraph 16 so many different times, I want to look at the first paragraph, paragraph 17, which usefully is a summary of paragraph 16 anyway. And that will give us all a chance to kind of gather our wits about us and see where we are. The supreme principle of the possibility of all intuition in relation to sensibility is, according to the transcendental aesthetic, that all the manifold of intuition should be subject to the formal conditions of space and time. That's just simply a statement of transcendental aesthetic, namely, whatever affects sensibility must be subject to space and time. Why should he state that here?
Where are you going to be?
I'm sorry, we're beginning paragraph 17. We're at B136.
Okay, thank you.
First sentence of paragraph 17. Why should he suddenly drag us back to the transcendental aesthetic? This juncture, having just done the I think in monotonous, repetitive, whatever.
Is it that part of the thought has to be about why does I have a manifold, one manifold, and if intuition is a means of receiving that manifold or getting information about it, he calls up the conditions under which I receive information to then say something further about how it is I can even talk about that manifold at all through a different faculty.
You started with one thought and ended with a second. Have to listen to your own arguments. You started with the claim that he was interested in the question of one manifold, but then you went on to say that in order to talk about that, you rightly went on to say he had to talk about the conditions under which we have any manifold whatsoever, which is the really crucial thought, namely, he brings it up here to underline the two sources of knowledge thesis. That discursive cognition is always going to be about both what is given to us what we do with it. That is both passivity and activity. And again, for Kant, the unity of activity and passivity is simply what he means by discursive cognition. And in ways I'm going to say a lot about today, the B deduction is nothing more than a regressive analysis of discursive cognition. So it's absolutely appropriate that he should begin here by reminding us that in talking about eventually the transcendental unity about perception, right, he's going to be talking about it as in relationship to the given. Because that's what an intuition does. Intuition has its origin in sensibility.
I'll save the heavy artillery as we go along. I won't slingshot at you now.
I haven't said anything yet. Or at least I hope what I mean to be saying are nothing but analytic truths. They're not obvious ones, I grant you, nothing being Kant is. We're working at a series of simply an analytic analysis of discursive cognition, which for Kant, because of the transcendental aesthetic, and because of what he says in paragraph 15, what does he say in paragraph 15? Anyone?
Combination. There must be a combination of this.
Whatever unity we have is a product of combination. No unity without unification. Right? So between the transcendental aesthetic and paragraph 15, you have the materials for the analytic claim that discursive cognition is going to be the combination of those two things. Second sentence. We can linger here. Insofar as, you should be warned, it's a long Kantian sentence, right? It's as if he had spent the evening before reading Proust and decided. Insofar as the manifold of representations of intuition are given to us, they are subject to the former of these two principles. Space and time. Insofar as they allow of being combined in one consciousness, they are subject to the latter. I skipped a sentence, didn't I? I'm sorry. I got so carried away. The second sentence is the supreme principle. That's the latter. So you're just setting up the supreme principle of the same possibility in its relation to understanding is that all the manifold of intuition should be subject to conditions of the original synthetic unity of apperception. So the supreme principle of the same possibility is the transcendental unity of apperception, which is to say that for Kant, all combination not only must involve a spontaneous synthesis, that's the argument of minimally of paragraph 15, because, just to repeat, combination cannot be given but must be produced, therefore combination rests on spontaneity. So the next thought is what that spontaneity does what's involved in spontaneity is my awareness of the manifold of intuition hanging together. My awareness of the manifold of intuition hanging together. My awareness of something as an object with certain characteristics. Just is what he means, I am claiming, by the transcendental unity of apperception. Otherwise, there would be an awareness of something for which I would not be aware, which is a contradiction in terms. So, the thought here is that unless the manifold of intuition can be thought can be grasped together in one self-consciousness, unless that were to occur, nothing could be cognized at all. And that's true simply in virtue of the notion of representation. You're looking puzzled. Why? Because what is representation? Representation is my taking some internal state and treating it as a representation of an objective state of affairs. That's simply what it is to have a representation. And we further said last week that since there can be unconscious representations, in order for me to have a cognition through a representation, then I must add self-consciousness to them. That is, I must take them up. But taking them up is but is treating my inner states as representing an objective state of affairs. That should allow us to go to the next sentence. Again, I want you to see the second sentence is analytic, right? It's just that if the manifold of intuition were not subject to the conditions of the original synthetic unity of our perception, that is, if the manifold of intuition were not grasped as representing an object, then I'd have no cognition at all. Right? That's why it really is an analytic statement. not one you might have known when you were 17 years old, but you're getting used to this. Insofar as the manifold representations of intuition are given to us, they are subject to the form of these two principles. Insofar as they must be allowed of being combined in one consciousness, they are subject to the latter, transcendentally being about perception. For, and now my claim is, this sentence states the analytic thesis I have just stated. So let's see if it's true. For, without such combination, nothing can be thought or known, since the given representations would not have in common the act of apperception, I think, and so could not be apprehended together in one self-consciousness. Just a series of equivalencies. So to summarize, if the manifold and intuition cannot be combined in one consciousness, then the manifold of intuition cannot be grasped in a self-consciousness. If it could not be grasped in a self-consciousness, nothing could be cognized through the manifold. So I'm doing it as a reductio, right? Since something is cognized through the manifold, okay? So if the manifold illusion cannot be combined in one consciousness, then nothing can be cognized through the manifold. That's a contradiction. Therefore, something must be able to be cognized through the manifold of intuition. That's the premise of the entire argument. In my reading, that something must be able to be cognized through the manifold of an intuition is the premise, since the negation, all those other things make that impossible. Therefore, the manifold of an intuition must be able to be combined in one consciousness. That's an analytic truth. You see, now you should be uncomfortable, because you've now gone really far down the Kantian path with a series of analytic truths. Okay. So, that's the summary of paragraph 16, which is to say, on this reading, paragraph 16, the so-called Dickerson Bowles the Master argument is really an elaboration of just that thought, the I thing must be able to accompany all my representations, or there would be nothing to me, and a variety of thought to show why the opposite of that entails simply that unless we grant that, there would be no cognition at all. So for me, the point of 16 is to reveal the I think as an analytic truth. Yeah.
But just to be clear, with the sort of running polemic of the course, and this is, you're giving a regressive reading of,
right.
Then I'm assuming then what you mean by the regressive reading is that you start with the premise that we have cognition.
Absolutely.
Whereas on the progressive story, so everyone you're arguing against isn't going to allow you that starting premise. Or at least would be less comfortable with it then.
They're going to interpret all of this slightly more robustly. They're going to have to do a lot more sweating than I am.
Okay.
And because I think being cool is being good. Now, I will get to the reason why the regressive a little later. I think it comes out more sharply a little bit later in the argument, and I'll say more. But yeah, I do not think that this is an anti-skeptical argument. That's what I mean by meaning it's a regressive argument. It begins, let's be clear again. A regressive analysis begins with the claim we have knowledge, and more precisely, we cognize an object, the world, through a manifold of intuition. But he's agreeing, I want to be clear, who's he agreeing with is any representationalist. Right? So he's taking a representationalist premise that he assumes that Locke in particular, but other representationalists would agree. Namely, if I'm in a representational state, I'm aware of a cup, then I have a awareness of an object in the world. And he's asking, if that's the case, how is it possible? If that's the case, how is it possible? He is not, on the anti-skeptical argument, begins with, I have experience, I'm self-aware, what are the conditions for the possibility of that? Where you work from the thin premise, it's a very thin premise, of let's call it Cartesian self-consciousness, and try to show that that necessitates awareness of a world independently of you. Kant has an argument close to that, and he calls it the refutation of idealism. And we'll look at it not next week, but the week after. So he does have an anti-skeptical argument of a kind, what he calls a critique of problematic idealism. But the fact that he has that argument is good evidence for me that he doesn't mean this to be that argument. That he has something in particular that he thinks of as the refutation of idealism means he doesn't think the rest of what he's doing is it. That's my reading. For someone like Weyer, just to give you a hint, Weyer says, oh, he realized that the transcendental deduction was a great failure, so in the refutation of idealism, he finally gets it right. As if the refutation of idealism is the only valid argument in the whole book, which is roughly what Weyer thinks. That just seems to me odd. Okay, so we're ready for paragraph 2 of paragraph 17, which is the core argument of paragraph 17. Understanding is, to use general terms, the faculty of knowledge. This knowledge consists in the determinate relation of given representations to an object. That's simply a restatement of the representational hypothesis. That is, what is knowledge? Knowledge consists in the determinate relation of given representations to an object. That is, taking my representational state, I judge this is a cup with a funny face on it. It's very odd. It really is a funny, it's called the mess, which is part of the face. I'm taking that state, that judgment, to be an awareness of an object. So I'm simply taking my judgment, the cup has a face on it, to be a way of treating my representation. Namely, as saying of the object, it has a face on it. So, what is an object? What do you mean by object? And here, and now, I would suggest he repeats the argument of A104. That is what I call, it's going to come back more than once in the deduction, the transcendental reinterpretation of the way of ideas. Because what he says is, what is an object? An object is that in the concept of which. You keep waiting for the object to be something out there. This is the Copernic. This is the Copernican term. This very sentence, give or take. An object is that in the concept of which the manifold of a given intuition is united. So an object, I will call something an object if and only if my manifold of intuitions hang together in a certain way, namely in a way in which allows me to say, so the concept of the cup unites the various features of it, including having a face, which is not a usual predicate for a cup. Let's let that go. So it's an object because of the way I treat my representations. So it's the way in which the representations are handled that gives them representational force, significance, meaning. Representation, so the notion of an object is had through the way in which we have certain representations. That is, we have them in a way that says, ha, this is an awareness of an object. It's not the only way in which we have representations. Ask anyone in the room who's ever been drunk. You can have representations that are not of objects, but of hallucinations, of all sorts of things, right? But some of our representations, and it's the character of, or the quality of, the kind of unity which they have, which form a relationship to an object. So the form is constitutive of the power of those representations to represent. Now, right, let me carry on with paragraph, and then I'm going to circle back to and discuss some of the problems with it, and then we can see where we are. Now, all unification of representations demands unity of consciousness in the synthesis of them. That's the easy thought. That's as it were, let's call it the my side thought, right? All unification of representations demands unity of consciousness in the synthesis of them. That's simply to say that the unity of representations requires unity of consciousness. That almost comes from the combination thesis. It's now what he's going to infer from that, let's call it the flip. It's like a flip tax, only it's good. That's going to raise the stakes. Consequently, and it's that sentence, it's that word consequently that drives all his critics crazy. So this is a bone of contention, right? Consequently, it is the unity of consciousness that alone constitutes, unity of consciousness constitutes the relation of representations to an object, and therefore their objective validity and the fact that they are modes of knowledge, and upon it therefore rests the very possibility of understanding. Okay, so here's where Kant's critics and friends even have lots of trouble. Because Kant seems to be, especially on the anti-skeptical argument, this looks like a fallacious argument. On the anti-skeptical reading, this looks like a fallacious argument. It's fallacious because he seems to be moving from the anodyne thought that the unification of representation requires unity of consciousness, which looks all right, to the unity of consciousness constitutes objectivity. In other words, he seems to be looking from a subjective condition for the possibility of knowledge, and saying that very subjective condition is the condition for objectivity. That's the way he seems to be arguing. And Guire, for example, thinks that Kant is simply here concocting a wildly fallacious argument. In his terms, he makes a necessary condition of knowledge, unity of representations, into a sufficient condition of knowledge. That's one way of thinking about why it may be fallacious. Or he is simply being stipulative, another complaint, defining an object as... Why is it stipulative? Because he seems to be defining objectivity in terms of unity, rather than, we do have another notion of object, namely independent of us, says Guire. So he seems to be doing away with that. So that's Guire's worries here. Allison, who we've been reading, some of you have been reading, it's a bit messier, but I'll have to come back to this later anyway. There are two words in German for object, and Gegenstand. And in the German, those words are floating around in this paragraph and throughout. And Allison decides that they mean different things. Roughly, Allison thinks that object means logical object of judgment, that is, simply, we will call anything an object that has a certain form, namely, unified through the transcendent of our perception. While Gegenstand, which means standing against, literally, right, is treated as, let's call it, the heavy notion of an object. And that's what's achieved only in paragraph 26. So that for Allison, Kant is not here making a mistake of moving from necessary to sufficient condition, but just defining the logical notion of an object. Now, it's here that I really think that using a regressive reading makes life much easier. again, the regressive argument wants to begin not from representations in general, but only from those very representations which are by definition those through which subjects cognize particular objects. I think that's what he's talking about. And when I read A104, I stipulated this as a Lockean premise. Let's just assume we have ideas that we think of as representing a world of things. How possible? So on the regressive argument, he's not attempting to prove that some set of representations are objective, rather just asking after the necessary conditions of objectivity. And in this case, he seems to be saying that the object of my cognition is precisely that which all the manifold components of, all the component representations hang together as representations of, and which I grasp as being presented to me by or in those representations. So I want to say that that sentence, when an object is that in the concept to which the manifold of given intuitions is united, for Kant is a necessary presupposition of representationalism. And we saw that, that's what we saw in A104, right? This is why I'm saying it's a repeat of A104, because in A104 is the argument that the transcendental object equals X. And we saw that there was no X, right? Because the X is the independent things to which they all related and in which they were all united would have to be, what? Another intuition, which is exactly what we lacked. So he said, well, look, we can't, you know, that's just going to repeat the representational circle. So we did the, you know, the turn and said, no. Instead of making the source of unity the object, the source of unity is in the subject. So, an object, maybe we're not going to finish the deduction. I think we're going great guns here, right? We read nearly two paragraphs. So the thought is, an object's presented to my awareness in virtue of my having a unified apperceptive awareness of a complex intuition. That's what it is for an object to be presented to my awareness. The unified apperception of the manifold is possible only if it is grasped as a unified complex whole through an act of spontaneous synthesis. That's where the spontaneous sense. I grasp it as a complex whole through the synthesis. That's how the presentation occurs. Now here's the kicker. If spontaneity is doing what I am saying it is doing, then the intuition on its own is blind. That is, an intuition that is not grasped through spontaneity has what? No representational force. Doesn't count as presenting an object to me. So without the synthesis, the intuition has no determinate representational content. Remember the experience of coming up from the subway. You're having intuitions, all right, you're just not cognizing anything through them. So, the unified grasp, the synthesis of an intuition, constitutes it as a representation of an object. So the force of where are we going with this? Where we're going with this is that the form through which I synthesize an intuition determines that something is a representational content überhaupt. That's the claim. So it's only through form. Let me give a linguistic analogy. I can see you're batting your head. I can see, even though there's very few walls here, each of you are kind of batting your head against the wall. Speak English, speak English. I'm trying. It's and here's the maybe use a Chomskyan kind of thought experiment. You can use words, you know, dreams, the, it's hard to do non-grammatical sentences, isn't it? What's the famous one he does? I can't remember it. But the point I'm driving at is we can get a series of words and they will not count as giving meaning. Why? Not because the words individually don't seem to have meaning, but because they can only have meaning if they're in a grammatical sentence. Hence the analogy is here, the idea of a grammatical sentence, the form is what allows the words to suddenly truly latch onto the world. Without that form, the words would just be so many little things that pop up in dictionaries, right? They would be an hallucination, right? Well, now you're trying to think the same thought with the idea of representational contents. It's exactly the same thought. which is why, for example, those of you who have read Michael Dummett's big book on Frege, the first big of Frege book, Frege can sound awfully like Kant. And David Bell's and Billy Friedlander's works on Frege, again, are explicit Kantian readings of Frege. Why? Because, again, Frege thinks what? Anybody? What's the crux of the Fregean term? That the sentence is the minimal unit. Comprehension. Not words, but sentences. That was the beginning of that term, which we're going to, I'm going to call later on, the movement from atomism to holism. And it works just as truly in the world of words as it does in the world of ideas. So somehow, what we're beginning to try to get at is how forms actually can have a determining role for contents to become contents of a certain kind, namely, have representational force, a representational authority, a representational meaning. So, the unity of apperception, let me just sum up a little bit, have a little break, and we'll go to paragraph 18. It's good. The unity of apperception, again, is the unified grasp of the component representations making up a complex intuition. Say that again. A definitional from the Canada Giving, which is following Dickerson. The unity of apperception is the unified grasp of the component representations making up a complex intuition. The unity of apperception is the unified grasp of them as hanging together. So the unity of apperception is the grasp of the component representations as hanging together, as making up a representation of a particular object. So, while Allison thinks that there is a reciprocal connection between the transcendental unity of apperception and the representation of objects as the goal of part one, I'm arguing it's not the goal, it's the premise. He's just trying to let that premise breathe a little bit. He's not trying to set it up. So I'm just saying it's explored. So apperception, on my account, is by definition the subject's capacity to grasp internal states as a presentation of objects. And by definition, an intuition is a representation through which a subject cognizes a particular object. You didn't know that for an hour, and I haven't. This shows that analytic truths are not tautologies. Either that or tautologies can be really hard. So if that's right, I'm still claiming that we've not gone very far beyond a kind of Lockean view. Of course, we're only saying that human cognition is a unified awareness of the manifold of an intuition. So that just sounds like an awareness of a Lockean idea. Yeah. Now, the necessary condition for that is that our cognition must involve a spontaneous synthesis and, this is going to be the bit we're going to get to, since, let me just make it obvious to you, I'm claiming that the form is doing the work of giving it, right, of giving the materials that are formed representational force. So I'm saying there must be something about the mind, our modes of thinking, that are essential to it. And to say that there's something essential to it is to say that our spontaneous activities achieve what they achieve because they are governed. Spontaneity is governed by something structural. Let's call it the categories. So, cognition must involve spontaneous synthesis, and spontaneous synthesis must be governed by categories. And that gets us exactly to what we're going to worry about in paragraph 18. Okay, let's have a three word, since I'm running out of